This episode of the UAV Digest is sponsored by GoEngineer, provider of design, engineering, and 3D printing solutions for the aerospace and unmanned vehicles industries. To learn more, visit the UAVDigest.com/GoEngineer. You're listening to episode 310 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm David Vanderhoof in Fort Washington, Pennsylvania. Hello, Max.
David, how are we doing? How are things at the helicopter museum? You have a new addition.
Yeah, we got it. Santa came early. We'd like to thank Lockheed Martin and Sikorsky. They donated a S-76 to us that we are... I'm in desperate need of a very large bow like you would see in a Lexus commercial to put on the front of the helicopter for Thursday. It's a really neat addition. We're looking forward to utilizing it. And it was a proof that I was getting healthier because I was helping moving the monster yesterday in the museum. So I felt that was quite an accomplishment given my trials and tribulations with health this year. Being able to push a helicopter around with no real side effects, knock on wood, was a good thing.
Very good.
You're back after a long journey, aren't you?
Oh, my gosh, yeah. Just shy of 4,000 miles in about a week and a half. So it's been a lot of driving, but back in the home studio, nice and comfy, and have all my equipment, and I just feel right back at home, so... Why don't we get started with a show on unmanned aircraft?
Oh, is that what we're doing? Oh, okay. Well, we've got sign up for a ride in a drone. I keep telling everybody I wanted to volunteer for that. Mapping a railway project, low altitude hurricane hunting. Another reported drone strike, this time with a news helicopter. A DHS warning for private industry, another round of financing for Precision Hawk. They seem to be hawkish and getting lots of money. And spying on hippos with drones. That sounds like it's going to be a very fat story. Should we get started?
Let's get started, David.
Well, Lyft Aircraft says 13,000 people have signed up for drone rides. Flights begin in beta mode in Texas. So Lyft Aircraft plans a 25-city tour in its Hexa passenger drone. On Lyft's website, you can get on the waiting list for a ride. And it's only going to be $149 to $249, depending on your flight duration. Okay, Max, are we going to ask listeners to make a GoFundMe contract so we can go fly in our drone?
Hey, for that price, I wonder how long those flight durations are, however. But this drone, this Hexa drone it's kind of interesting. It looks a little bit different than most of the urban air mobility drones or passenger drones you see. This is a single seater, and the rotors are all up above you. So you've got an array of, 18 rotors with a cockpit, I guess, kind of an open, no doors, but suspended underneath it. And then below that are, I don't know what, probably batteries in there, but there are some like pontoons and floats. So this thing is supposed to be able to float on water. Interesting device.
I wonder how tall it is, because I like the fact that the rotors are above your head and they are sort of locked in a case where we've talked about it in the past about people's concerns about getting in and out of vehicles with rotating blades. And some of these aerial mobility ones are, the blades are a lot lower to the ground. It's definitely interesting. It looks like a tree, you know, it's got roof at the bottom.
It
sort of looks like a tree. If you want to get into it and get comfortable in it, it's interesting that they've gone with only one passenger, which is going to be unique. Most of our other urban air mobility vehicles that we've talked about are two passenger, four passenger. In this case, it's only one. So it's if you got a bunch of people leaving the party, you're going to have multiple vehicles.
Yeah, you'll need some space for that. But I guess this is their first drone, and maybe we'll see some increased passenger capacity in some other models if this proves to be a feasible project. They say it's really simple to fly. It's got a autopilot computer, triply redundant, they say, and you control it with a single three-axis joystick. Or you can tap your location on the 7-inch touchscreen, and they call that "look, mom, no hands" mode, I guess. So off it goes. It's carbon fiber, weighs 432 pounds. They say it complies with the FAA's powered ultralight classification, so no pilot's license required to fly. We do have a video that we can show you. It'll be in the show notes for this episode, and that does give you a sense for kind of the size. It is flying in this video, although at very, very low altitude. But the pilot says that he's also flown helicopters, regular helicopters, and he says it's about 5% of the difficulty of flying a Robinson helicopter, so by comparison.
It can fly and land safely up to 6 motors disabled. So you can lose one third of your motors and you can still fly safely. This will make our SR-22 fans happy. It's fitted with an automatic ballistic parachute. Mr. Trescott will definitely want to take part of that. And the whole aircraft airbag system. I wonder what that is. I have pictures of it being like the Martian lander, where the airbags sprout up everywhere and you just go bouncing down the hill until you come rolling to a stop.
Yeah, I'm not sure what that looks like, but that's kind of what it sounds like. They do say that while they're still accepting additions to the waiting list on their website, they do say that the New York, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Dallas, and Austin stops in this tour are already sold out. Seattle and Portland still have some availability. So if take a look at this, if you look at the video, I guess, and think that this is something you might want to try, go on over to the website, links in the show notes, and you can register to get on the waiting list.
And it's going to be a 25-city tour, so there, I'm sure, going to be more cities opened up. Now, if anybody from Lyft is around, we'd like you to stop in Philadelphia and Connecticut. Max and I would like to do our media ride in it, you know, so that we can promote you in general, just to throw that out there. So what if Norfolk Southern develops an effective UAV program but did not come without some trial and error? My ears perked up. I don't think we've actually talked about UAVs and trains in all of our years, but it's that time of year. It's Christmas, and Christmas means choo-choo trains, at least electric trains in my household. December was a no airplane, all train month in growing up as a kid. So here we've got UASs and choo-choos.
Norfolk Southern Railway asked a series of questions. They asked, what if they could use low-cost drones to take perspective shots of troubling project areas and share them with the project team in the office? And they asked, what if these photos could be stitched together to get an updated, sort of a Google Earth kind of aerial or mosaic of their project? And what if this big mosaic even had the third dimension added, elevations? So they asked themselves these questions, and they did some research to see what was out there, and they defined their mission, which was to find out if they could generate 5 miles of survey-grade data and then use that data to prepare construction drawings with entry-level drones and photogrammetry software. So it's the story of an organization that didn't have experience, or at least not with drones in this area, and they wanted to see what they could learn by trying to do it. And it's kind of an interesting piece, David, in that they weren't entirely successful, but they learned a lot.
This is a lesson in trial and error, and with not a bad outcome. They weren't perfect. They didn't reach all of their goals, but they took a lot of measured learning from it to move forward. You know, not all of this stuff works the way you might think it does, but in this case, it worked out somewhat better than they were expecting. Their first attempt was after they got a Part 107 license, they designated a 5-meter linear project or a 5-mile linear project. And the first attempt, they flew the flights, they collected the data, spent several days with the software, and the results were unusable. Half the drone photos were unusable, and the data points still didn't line up. So first round, they successfully flew, but weren't able to process the data. And then they went to a second round.
They found improved results, still not entirely survey grade, but much better than the first attempt. They found some problems. One example is noted is they had large variations where the vegetation was dense. So they learned a lot. They got better. And in this article, they describe some of the lessons they learned, things that they can use as best practice for future projects. And some of these things may be pretty sound pretty familiar to people who've done this kind of thing before, have some experience. But for these first-timers, what they learned was that they need to use multiple flight plans. As a rule of thumb, they say the more pictures you have for an area, the better. They decided that they need to use many different camera angles, need to set ground control points, and overlap the flight envelopes.
And finally, overlay the desired survey area and manually filter out the bad data. Now, like you said, Max, this sounds pretty obvious to a lot of people in, who listen to this show because they do this all the time. Keep in mind that this was a railroad company, that their job is to haul stuff back and forth on tracks and stuff. They're not in the drone industry. And also, this was a magazine article catered towards the railroad industry. So it was their lessons learned may seem a bit obvious to us, but they were very practical. And it sounds like Norfolk Southern did a good job of slowly, you know, trying to make the information work. You know, one of the things I've been meaning to say on the last couple of weeks is I've been watching a lot of shows on Science Channel. I have a deep-rooted thing about archaeology and antiquities, et cetera. That's part of my background that I don't talk about a lot. But a lot of their new shows, one of their biggest factors, one of the things they use are drones. There's quite a few of them where, and they've used drones for various things to find hidden sites and stuff, and they've used LIDAR. So if you're very interested in that kind of technology, check out some of the archaeology sites like Unexplained and Unknown, where they're actually admitting they're using drones now, and they're using drones for the surveying purpose and the technology purpose, much like what they did in this article. So I would suggest check out Science Channel. A lot of cool stuff.
One other thing that occurred to me as I was reading this article, David, is that it's kind of an interesting, I don't know if you call it a case study, but it makes you think about, do you outsource this process or do you develop the skills internally? In this case, the organization decided to develop the skills internally. Another approach that a company could take would be to instead hire an outside company to perform these drone services for you. And I think different companies in different situations could pick one over the other as being the proper approach. But you can roll your own and learn by your own mistakes and develop the knowledge in-house, or you can just hire somebody to do it for you. Different companies will make different choices.
Or Max, you could try to do it yourself and realize that maybe it's far more complicated than you think it is. And your lesson takeaway, your main takeaway is, okay, let's hire somebody else professionally that do this. But at least somewhere you've set up your specs. So, there's a lot of things. Nothing bad came out of this experiment because they've had a lot of takeaways. And it sounds like Norfolk Southern was very positive. So good for them.
Yeah.
Well, let's move on from choo-choos to large blowing windstorms. I still find this amazing. The word drone and hurricane in a title just blows my mind. But drones provide new frontier in hurricane observations. This was from weathernation.com. And hurricane hunters fly through hurricanes, but not at sea level where the winds are the strongest. That portion of the storm lifts energy and moisture. So, to paraphrase Stephen Sondheim, send in the drones.
Yeah, disposable drones in this case. Now, here scientists have been flying the Raytheon Coyote drone into hurricanes as low as 360 feet. Now, these are expendable, tube-launched, obviously fixed-wing drones that can take these kind of environmental conditions. And it's allowed the scientists to measure the atmospheric conditions in winds as much as, now get this, man, 194 miles an hour. And they use the NOAA's P-3 reconnaissance aircraft to deploy these Raytheon Coyotes.
And the observations will help determine the shifts and fluctuations of the gusts, the interaction of the hurricane winds with the ocean surface. So when we talk about hurricane hunting, normally out of the P-3s and out of the Air Force C-130s, they use sonar buoys where they push the sonar parachute-dragged vehicles into the hurricane as they're flying through it. And it radios back, but that only carries that little portion down to the ground. In this case, you're getting a broader survey area with better data. And the fact that you can launch them out of the same sonar tubes, that makes it even better because you're actually fitting to existing technology. So, but we got some more information from Raytheon.
Yeah, the Coyote UAS is actually used in a variety of different mission types, including surveillance and electronic warfare and strike. And it's designed for interchangeable payloads. It'll operate for up to an hour. And the U.S. Army, in fact, has selected the Coyote drones for a near-term counter-UAS solution. And another thing that the Coyote drones can do is swarming. Now, you can go back way, way back these days to 2016, and there were some demonstrations conducted on land and at sea where they had more than two dozen of these Coyote systems successfully swarming and moving in formation. And in doing that, they were demonstrating the effectiveness of autonomous networking. So that's obviously an important part of swarming. But back to the hurricanes, there is a paper that's recently been published in the Bulletin of the American Meteorological Society on this. It's called Eye of the Storm, Observing Hurricanes with a Small Unmanned Aircraft System. And we'll have a link to that paper in the show notes. So if you're interested in diving into that a little bit more, you can.
So let's move on to, I don't know, do we call this your grounded file? This is Air 7 HD struck by a suspected drone over downtown Los Angeles.
Right. Los Angeles ABC affiliate KABC, reported that their helicopter was struck in flight by an object. Now, they landed the helicopter without an incident, but the pilot and the reporter on board heard a loud bang and felt something as an object struck the tail of the chopper. Now, this was at night, 7:15 p.m. They were flying at 1,100 feet, and they figured it was a bird strike, but they decided that they really, out of an abundance of caution, should land the helicopter and take a look and see what this thing was, which they did. And this article has a photo, but I don't know, David, what do you see when you look at this picture of the damage?
Well, this one sounds a little, it's interesting. I've got to give the pilots credit. Contrary to previous stories where something happened and they immediately thought it was a drone, in this case, they thought it was a genuine bird strike. And then the damage did not meet what would be considered a bird strike. So, it's tough to tell. I know that I want to follow this because I know the National Transportation Safety Board got involved with it. So maybe one of our top secret people in that organization could let us in on the information. But I think that maybe this actually was a hit, though 1,100 feet is kind of, these occur at such altitudes that you just wonder who's flying aircraft at that altitude and how big was this aircraft to do the damage that this caused.
Also, the damage seems to be in two locations on the helicopter. There's one area that looks almost like more of a scuff and some deformation of the metal. And then it's hard to tell how far away from it, a foot or 2 feet maybe. There's looks like a hole punched in, but I don't know. Just the relative types of damage.
Well, the first one's the initial strike, and then it bounces off as the helicopter's moving forward. And the second, I don't know. I'm speculating. And the photograph we've gotten is not the greatest in the world. So I think we're going to follow up on this one because if any of the ones we've talked about over the years that have been strikes, quote unquote, I believe that this might actually be one. It's just, again, my biggest concern is who's flying an aircraft at night or at dusk at 1,100 feet, with a UAS, and what was their purpose doing that? So, all right, let's move on to more depressing news. How about a warning from the Department of Homeland Security about privacy using foreign-made drones?
Last month in November, the FBI's Cyber and Infrastructure Security Agency issued a bulletin. They sent it to private industry. And in that bulletin, they warn about the risk of exposing private data when using UAS that have been manufactured outside the United States. The bulletin warns of possible data compromise when operating UAS, quote, designed, manufactured, or supplied abroad where the data is stored, transferred to, or accessible by servers in a foreign country. Well, yeah. I mean, when you have data, company data, that is proprietary or company restricted, you don't want others to have access to it, then you have to pay attention to where's that data stored. And if the data is stored in a server in another country, you have no control over that.
Well, and this is one of those statement of the obvious, but in this kind of thing, you're thinking about the drone and but you're not talking about a couple of steps down the line where, for security protection. So you got your drone, you're flying it, and you're downloading the data into the computer, but you're thinking that's a closed loop when in fact it's probably not. And anymore with any information on the cloud, it's definitely not.
Yeah, these days, you have to pay attention to where is that data going, who has access to it. And the point here is that while the country in which you reside may have good, strong privacy laws, I mean, let's just even take that as an assumption, that's not true in every country. And in other countries, in some countries, the government has the ability to demand data, information from private companies in those countries. And so there is no protection. Now, it's interesting, in this bulletin, DJI is not mentioned by name anywhere. But when DJI was contacted about this, they emphasized that the only data associated with customers in mainland China is stored in servers located in China, and the data from all other users is always kept on secure Amazon Web Services servers, as AWS servers, in the United States. That's been DJI's position, I think, all along. But, you know, if you've got data that you don't want either your competitors or another foreign entity to have, then you got to pay attention to where that data is.
Or you just find a couple of $1 million to hide your data, or in this case, $32 million. And this is our friends at Precision Hawk. They raised $32 million to advance next phase of growth in commercial drones. This was from businesswire.com, and with a link to their company's post. So Precision Hawk raised $32 million to forward their empire, sort of.
Yeah, this came from a investment group, some venture investors. And Precision Hawk says that they're going to use this money to innovate with their Precision Analytics AI-powered platform. That's an aerial data analytics platform. They're also going to use the funds to accelerate some sales initiatives and further market expansion. So, yeah, Precision Hawk is very closely watching this market and watching it accelerate, and they're doing their best to obtain the funding so that they can participate in that growth fully.
And move the ball further down the field. So good for them. So our last story comes from our writer of animal stories and animal lovers, Heather. This was spying with drones to help conservation efforts.
Hippo conservation efforts.
Hippo conservation efforts.
Yeah, the University of New South Wales, their conservationists are using drones to monitor hippos in Africa. Now, hippos in Africa are a threatened species, and they're somewhat difficult to monitor with conventional techniques because they're aquatic, they're nocturnal, they're aggressive. And as a result of that, they have not been studied to the degree that, you might think, considering that they're somewhat endangered. So here again, we see the use of drones to monitor them being an effective tool.
Yeah, hippos are big, nasty, and mean, but they're not the lovable purple hippos that we're used to seeing in Hungry, Hungry Hippos. But the population is declining because of habitat loss and the hunting for meat and ivory. And like you said, they're nocturnal and amphibious and aggressive. Well, one of my all-time favorite pictures is a picture I took in San Diego Zoo where it's a hippo underneath the water with a duck above it. It makes me very happy because you can see both of them. But hippos are very fast-moving. They're another moving target and the conservation needs to pay attention to. And like a lot of other endangered species, the best way to monitor them is via drone, and so that you can count them like we've talked about before and monitor their circumstances and protect them if necessary, if they're being poached, etc. So it's definitely hippopotamuses. And I thought, and Heather's going to hate me for this, but with Christmas coming up, I thought a hippopotamus story was a really good idea because all I want for Christmas is a hippopotamus.
Oh, it's interesting that they're getting good results with just a plain old DJI Phantom 4. you know, showing that, well, for one thing, those phantoms are sure capable, but also that, you know, you can use off the shelf, basically consumer or prosumer equipment in order to, you know, accomplish these great things, which is pretty cool.
And I'm sure that the more they advance, they get the better technology they have. So with that, I think we're good. I think, Max, we should wrap this up.
All right. Thank you all for listening to episode 310 of the UAV Digest. As always, you can find us on our website, theuavdigest.com. If you want to go right to the show notes for this episode, just look for theuavdigest.com/310.
And of course, you can find us on social media. You can become part of our Slack listener team. You can do that by sending us an email to feedback@theuavdigest.com. You can find us on Twitter @UAVDigest and on Facebook, facebook.com/UAVDigest. I looked today and I have a request for all of you folks out there. Our last review on iTunes was January of 2019, and here we're in December and we haven't gotten anything newer. So if you're a recent listener and you like the show, leave us some feedback on whatever podcatcher you use so that we can continue to grow our listener base, because the better reviews you give us, the better off we are and the higher we show up so that we can provide more people, etc., going forward. So I guess, Max, we've got one more episode this year, and then it's off to 2020.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it, David.
With that, I'm going to say this is David in Fort Washington.
And Max in Hartford.
Thanks for listening.